Hi, I'm Christopher Ward. Welcome back to Whatever It Takes, the podcast, an introduction to the audiobook version of Stephen Stone's memoir, a book he describes as life lessons from Degrassi and elsewhere in the world of music and television. And if you've enjoyed the podcast, well, please tell your friends and maybe buy the full Whatever It Takes book, which is available in print, ebook, and audiobook formats at your favorite bookstore or digital platform. Stephen, I know this next chapter as if it were my own story, which, of course, it is in part.
Exactly.
Now, you and I have been students of the great songwriting teams through the years. Bacharach and David, Holland, Dozier and Holland, and, of course, the mighty Lennon and McCartney. How do you think we did in applying what we learned from the masters?
Well, you're absolutely right in saying that we were students. We were avid students. We took songwriting very seriously, and though none of the songs you and I wrote together back in the early days ever achieved worldwide success, we did write, and you as an artist recorded, some songs which rose to the top of the pop charts, at least in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And indeed this month, Warner's is re-releasing the Spark of Desire album, which contains those songs, to mark the 45th year anniversary of the original release.
Right.
Now, of course, you went on to become very prolific as a songwriter on your own, including one of the top songs of all time, Black Velvet, which reached number one with a bullet on the Billboard charts and is still played worldwide to this very day.
Well, Stephen, there's a cool story about Black Velvet in the book, but the excerpt we're going to play now goes back nearly half a century to those early songs which you and I wrote together. So let's relive how it all began.
While I was still in law school, someone from the past returned to my life. I was in Peterborough at an informal reunion of friends from Trent University on one of those fine fall days that Canada is famous for, brisk but sunny, the leaves on the trees bursting with color. Someone mentioned that I must be pleased to know that Christopher Ward was also coming over to the reunion. No, I did not want to see Christopher. But suddenly there he was, heading toward me, guitar in hand. I made some polite conversation before turning to get away. He stopped me. "Stephen, maybe you can help me. I've been offered a recording deal by WEA." WEA was short for Warner Elektra Atlantic, now Warner Music. "I hear you're in law school. Could you maybe help me negotiate the contract?" "Not me," I replied. "I'm not a lawyer yet. But I could ask George Miller, who should be able to help you." He thanked me, and once more, I turned to get away. He stopped me again. "Would you like to hear the song WEA wants to record as the single?" I was trapped. I could only listen to the song as any polite Canadian would before finally making my escape. It seemed to take ages for him to tune the guitar and then finally to start singing the song. I was fidgeting while others at the reunion circled around and hushed so that we could all listen in. As Christopher started playing, though, I found myself being quite drawn in. It was a simple country song, but it spoke to the heart, and when the final chorus ended, I would have been glad to hear it again. Indeed, everyone in the room clapped and encouraged an encore. As I was finally able to leave, I found myself saying to Christopher, "That really was a very beautiful song. I've got to go, but well done. I understand why WEA wants to sign you to a contract." He looked me straight in the eye and said, "You idiot." I was stunned at his rudeness, and in my anger, now felt fully justified in immediately walking out. Then he added, "You wrote the song." I didn't know what he meant until he reminded me of a song called "Must Have Lost My Way" we'd written together during the month that he and I performed songs nightly at the Playboy Club in Ankara, Turkey. At that time, the lyric had centered around a traveler who was starting to wonder exactly what he was traveling toward and who was increasingly thinking about the girl he had left back in his hometown. So there were phrases like, "Lost in memories," and "I don't seem to know my mind," and "looking for something to find." Christopher had completely rewritten the lyrics, changing the traveler into a lover who was lost in reverie while listening to a song on a jukebox, although there were still traveling references, and calling the song Lost in a Love Song. He reminded me that it was during our travels in Europe and Turkey that I had been key to his learning the art of songwriting, and he recalled a conversation between us in a campsite in Spain early in our travels.
Christopher, what's a middle eight? Stephen, the middle eight bars of a song, also called the bridge. You know, the I don't want to sound complaining section of Please Please Me? Christopher, right. Stephen, or the and when I touch you part of I want to hold your hand? They like that one so much they used it twice. Christopher, I think we need one of those.
At the time, I had been writing songs for a few years, while Christopher was just getting started. He hadn't then really grasped the structural side of the craft, so his songs had tended to ramble a bit. Maybe he'd been listening to Van Morrison's Astral Weeks too much, if that's possible.
Christopher. Stephen had an innate grasp of chord structure and how a melody could develop over the course of a song for a greater emotional payoff. I was the attentive student. I was also the designated lyricist. So a songwriting partnership was struck, old school style, or Elton and Bernie style, where there's more or less a strict division of labor, rather than the Beatles' tendency to write chunks of songs, at least like they did in the early days. I think Lost in a Love Song, originally called Must Have Lost My Way Now, with the too clever second line, Looking for Something to Find, was the first real song that we wrote together. And it was the first of many, as my debut album contained almost exclusively Stone Ward co-writes.
Fairly soon thereafter, George did work with Christopher to sign the deal with WEA, though George insisted that I learn about recording contracts by being the front man in the negotiations. The experience taught me a lot about an important element of negotiating, bargaining power, namely that we had none. Try as I did, I was able to make almost no changes to the standard agreement. Gary Muth was the head of A&R, Artists and Repertoire, for WEA at the time.
Gary, in those days, you basically took the deal that the record company gave you. There was hardly any negotiating with anybody. The actual contract was printed, and you'd write in some percentages, and that would be it. The artists were just glad to be in the studio. I remember talking with Andy Kim about his early days, and he said, "We didn't care about the paper. All we wanted to do was get in the studio."
Despite the one-sided negotiations, or more to the point, lack of negotiations, Christopher signed the deal, and the first single released was indeed Lost in a Love Song. It was a minor hit on the Canadian country charts, enough to get Christopher's contract extended to record a full album. The royalties from the song were enough for Christopher and I to share a season ticket package for the Toronto Maple Leafs Hockey Club, seated in the highest possible row, furthest from the ice surface, in the grays, but season tickets nonetheless. More importantly, it meant Christopher needed to write more songs. The person I'd thought I never wanted to see ever again was a friend once more, and we were going to write an album together.
Lost inside a love song, the time was like an open road. Half a mile from sundown, cowboys on the radio.
Over the next 6 months, Christopher challenged me to come up with some more melodies that he could then add lyrics to. It was slow work, particularly with everything else going on in my life. By June, we still hadn't made enough progress, so I decided to head up alone to our family cottage in beautiful Georgian Bay and do nothing but write. The cottage was rustic. It had no electricity, but did have a wonderful view of the sunsets across the bay and out to Lake Huron. More importantly, for my purposes, It also had a sturdy old Heintzman upright piano. In those days, the most important radio station in North America was CKLW at 800 on the AM dial, known as the Big Eight in the Motor City. The transmitters were actually located in Windsor, Ontario, but it billed itself as a Detroit radio station. It beamed into almost 30 U.S. states and was the number one radio station in 8 of those states. For inspiration, I set up a portable radio on the piano, listened to CKLW, and watched the beautiful sunsets. As a fun visualization, I imagined hearing the song I was working on being broadcast over the Big Eight. I concentrated on melodies, not trying to make any sense of the words. We didn't know at the time that this was a common practice among songwriters, and that those original nonsense words are called dummy lyrics. There were several song fragments and one song that resulted from that first cottage writing sojourn. The song started with a monotonous duotone back and forth melody to the dummy lyric, "Sun is sinking in the silence, the surfers shout. Summer moon is a diamond in the house." And ended with the chorus, "Surfing is gone now, surfing is over." Repeated over and over. It was an homage to Brian Wilson and the Beach Boys, and I imagined it starting with a sound like a circus calliope, droning back and forth, before breaking out into an unexpected melody, straining sixth and ninth notes against root chords until the tension released into the chorus. I was thinking of the time at the end of the summer, at sunset on the last day of surfing. A bittersweet time when a wonderful season has produced lasting memories, but it is now ended. It didn't matter that I knew nothing of surfing. Neither did Brian Wilson. Christopher later rewrote the lyrics to describe the bittersweet uncertainty of blooming love. That wonderful time when in one moment you know that the person you love truly loves you, and in the next you are ravaged by doubts and are convinced that it's all over. So the opening lyric became, "Love will linger in a moment of breathless night. Summer moon is a diamond in the sky." The chorus became the beautifully evocative, "Once in a long time, love is a sweet dream. Gone with the night wind, once you believe it." It was nearly 18 months later when we went into the studio and recorded the song. There were some truly great session players on the track, including Steve Ferrone from the Average White Band on drums, Randy and Michael Brecker on horns, and Peter Appleyard on vibes. Mo Kaufman, Doug, Dr. Music Riley, Guido Basso, Sandy Tarano, and Jack Waldman also contributed. The great Jack Richardson of the Guess Who fame produced the session. The string section came from the Toronto Symphony Orchestra. We were still working on other songs for the album when we had decided to immediately release Once in a Long Time as a single. The weekend it was released, I was once again on my own at the cottage, and I tried listening to some of the smaller radio stations to see if our song might start to get some airplay. Unknown artists almost never got played right away on the big radio stations, like the Big Eight in Detroit or 1050 Chum in Toronto. They always waited for smaller radio stations to take a chance, to see if the audience liked it. But no such luck. None of the small stations had started to play the song. I sat down at the piano, looked out at the sunset, and switched the radio to the Big Eight for some inspiration. My mind had drifted away as they rambled on about the Detroit weather and traffic, so it took a little while to register. The song intro the announcer was talking over sounded awfully familiar. Then the lyrics started in, "Love will linger in a moment of breathless night." I jumped up and down and danced all around the cottage, and I cried.
Till love comes again.
The rush of adrenaline that came every time we heard the song on the radio was intoxicating. In the end, Once in a Long Time wasn't the big worldwide hit that we hoped it would be, but it did reach the top 10 across Canada. We made good use of that adrenaline. While the radio airplay and sales were rising, we channeled our energy into writing more songs to complete the album. As head of A&R at WEA, Gary Muth had secured small offices for his department in the Midtown Yorkville area of Toronto, far away from the rest of WEA, which was located in the industrial suburbs. The offices were on the second floor of a two-story Victorian brick building. The ground floor housed an answering service that, coincidentally, was the service that Christopher and I and many of our friends used. Just to explain, an answering service was an early version of voicemail. Your phone calls were answered by live operators who connected directly with your home telephone. Gary had a back office, complete with piano, that he offered to Christopher and me to use for our songwriting. It was particularly handy for me, since the University of Toronto Law School was only a short walk away.
Gary. Stephen wasn't a lawyer at the time, he was still a student. He would always drop by after his classes and do his work in the back office. And Christopher used to rehearse his band in the basement. It was a dirty, grotty basement that years before had been a nightclub. The ceilings were so low, Christopher referred to it as the Club Quasimodo.
One day, Gary called us into his front office to deliver some difficult news. "It's going well," he said. "There's some really great songs, but I just don't hear a hit single." The upshot was that until we created a single, we wouldn't be going into the studio to record the full album. Coming out of the meeting, we were despondent, partly to vent frustration and partly as a weak attempt at gallows humor. Christopher said sarcastically, "Well, that's simple, Stephen. You're heading up to the cottage this weekend. Why don't you come back Monday with a hit for us?" I played along, saying, "Will do, but you have to accept two conditions." The first condition was easy enough for Christopher to accept. The song would end with him sustaining a note that was at the very top of his range, ultimately to be surrounded by swirling strings, horns, and drums when produced. The second condition was just a joke. I suggested that midway through the song, it would arbitrarily shift upward in key by a half tone. Christopher choked at this, as I knew he would. That kind of key change was, in his mind, a sleazy songwriter trick to imply something new and creative in the melody, when in fact there was really nothing new or creative at all. "No, that sounds like Barry Manilow," he cried. "Exactly," I responded. "Take it or leave it." And with that, we laughed and headed our separate ways for the weekend. Then something almost miraculous happened. Having set the goal of creating a hit single, I worked furiously on a melody all weekend long. Yes, the melody started out low and gradually worked its way upward until it hit a high, sustained note at the end. And yes, the key arbitrarily shifted upward by a half tone coming out of the middle eight. When I got back from the weekend and played the song for Christopher, he loved it, all of it. He even swallowed the half-tone upshift. And he immediately set about creating lyrics. The opening lines reflect the loss you feel when love goes sour. "How I've fallen from your favor, the sweet love you've taken away. The sound of goodbye echoes all through the night, and I must wait through lost days." This led to the chorus, "Maybe your heart will be broken in two, like mine." More to the point, once Gary Muth heard the song, he loved it too. And we were given the immediate go-ahead to record the full album, with emphasis on Maybe Your Heart as the new single. The song was a big success, top 10 across the country and number one in various centers, including, of all places, Quebec City. It got a lot of airplay throughout Canada, including on the Big 8 in Detroit and Chum in Toronto. People related to the song, and we heard numerous stories from people we didn't even know about how Maybe Your Heart affected their lives, like having to pull their car over to the side of the road when they heard the song because it made them cry. While I credit the success of all our songs to Christopher's lyrics, Christopher has always been very celebratory of my melodies. This mutual admiration is probably why our partnership worked so well.
Christopher, for a few years our work was heard a lot on Canadian radio, and I think it was the soaring melodies that made that happen. I couldn't have written a melody like Once in a Long Time or Maybe Your Heart, but they were a joy to sing. Those songs still sound good to me, and when I hear one on the radio, it always makes me happy.
Once again, we had visualized some things, and they had in many ways come true. Neither Once in a Long Time nor Maybe Your Heart made it onto the Billboard charts. In that sense, their success was limited. But they had been recorded and released and had met with at least some national success. This visualization thing seemed to be working, at least in part.
This concludes this episode of Whatever It Takes, the podcast, which has been produced by Elizabeth Baird and featured Stephen Stone, along with yours truly, Christopher Ward. If you enjoyed the podcast, you might like to tell your friends and perhaps buy the full Whatever It Takes book, which is available in print, ebook, and audiobook formats at your favorite bookstore or digital platform. We'll be back with a new episode next week.